What's up, guys? Today is January 26, 2022, and welcome to this interview here that we're going to be conducting with the lead attorney for Kerry Lake in the Lake v. Hobbs case that's under appeal right now. Kurt Olson is an absolute patriot. He's been fighting not just in this Lake v. Hobbs, he's been fighting the whole way, going back to when Donald Trump was in office. He's been a nonstop patriot fighting for election integrity, among other things. He's worked closely with the campaign out there, and he did an excellent job, in my opinion, in the original case that we heard last month. And, you know, of course, it didn't go our way, but there's a lot of scrutiny that I personally have in the way that that case was handled by the judge. I think it was a very unfair case, and I think that it's something that we as United States citizens, we need to be concerned about the bar that was set in that case moving forward. And I don't say this just as a conservative, as a Republican and all that. I say this as an American citizen, because sometimes the shoe might be on the other foot, and this is something that was incredibly unfair to the candidate here, the burden that was set. So without further ado, I want to go ahead and bring on my guest for today, Mr. Kurt Olson. Kurt, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us. You have been, I mean, you've just everything that has to do with election integrity over the last couple months, you've been involved. It feels like you've been involved in some way. And we finally got this groundbreaking case where we got a judge that's going to hear this on the merits, and we're actually going to get to present evidence and everything along those lines. And then we get in there. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I was watching, we live streamed the trial. We did a lot of coverage of the trial. And the whole time I'm watching this and reading, you know, the bar that's set for this trial, it felt more like this was a criminal case and you were a prosecutor that had to set, like, I mean, there was just so many different things. You had to show, you know, that there was intent. You had to show the exact number. You had to show who did what. You know, it was like a game of Clue. It was Colonel Mustard in the kitchen with the candlestick maker. Is that an unfair assessment?
Well, it's actually, it was even a higher standard than what you just described, because what the judge required was for us to prove intent to affect the election, essentially by clear and convincing evidence that the election was rigged. It was the whole ball of wax from start to finish, you know, that we had to prove that the defendants, by clear and convincing evidence, intended to rig the election. And I want to, you know, back up just for a second. When you say people think, well, this was a trial, this is an election contest. And so that's why it moved so quickly from the election to trial within a matter of weeks. We were not afforded, you know, a normal trial, you have discovery. You're allowed to seek documents. You're allowed to take depositions. You're allowed to do all of these things to help prove your case. What we did, we didn't have any of that, except we did have, because it's in the statute for election contests, that you can inspect the ballots. And that proved to be, that one event proved to be a gold mine with Clay Parikh. But the other evidence that we presented was developed in with people like myself and other Shelby Bush and a whole team of people working 24/7 to develop the evidence on the chain of custody, on the signature verification issues, on the tabulator issues, collecting hundreds of declarations. So the standard, which applies in the normal context, was even more difficult to meet because we didn't get to go in and get documents from the defendants to take their depositions beforehand. It was an extraordinary burden, but in many ways, whether wittingly or not, it was a gift, because the burden is so outside the bounds of the law that in and of itself is a very discreet, powerful issue on appeal, which we think that we're going to prevail on, just on that issue alone.
So originally going into this, you had 10 counts, and I don't know the 10 counts off the top of my head. I have a general idea of all them. The two counts that you ended up getting were the tabulator. What was it exactly? It was the tabulator, the ballot
rejections by the tabulators, with the chaos that happened on Election Day, which the defendants have tried to downplay. They've referred to it as, quote unquote, a hiccup, or as minor technical difficulties to be expected during any election. And the evidence, and including some incredibly explosive evidence coming out of the system log files, which put the lie to their characterization of that of the events that day as a mere hiccup. So that was claim one, yes, on the tabulators.
And then so the second claim after that was the chain of custody, and that's where we got Heather Honey that came in and did an excellent job showing that the chain of custody is just absolutely in shambles. It's pretty much non-existent. I mean, from the post office to Runbeck, there's next to no chain of custody. Now, I made the argument, and let me know if you think that this is a sound argument, but I made the argument that this would be the equivalent. I use this reference a lot. This would be the equivalent of arriving at a crime scene and seeing a dead body down there. And then the only thing you're allowed to do is go in and say, yes, that body is a dead body. And yes, it does look like it was a murder. And the judge says, okay, now show us how it was done. The things that you just found, the rejection rate from the tabulators and the chain of custody, is nothing more than evidence that shows there needs to be a further investigation. The fact that the chain of custody is violated is not going to prove that any of the ballots are illegitimate or that the ballots are not authentic, that the signatures aren't proper. You basically laid out, and you guys did extremely well in doing so, you laid out that, yes, there was something afoul here and we need to go further with our examination. We need to look at the signatures. We need to look at the slog files and the rejection rate on the machine, the ballot definitions. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think certainly you can always dig more, and we are continuing our investigation as we speak, the system log files being one example. But I believe we've proven our case. So for example, with chain of custody, we've proven that they didn't follow chain of custody procedures for about 300,000 ballots on election day. They deviated from the mandatory procedures on election day. 300,000 ballots that were transferred from Maricopa to Runbeck don't have chain of custody. But that, there's more than that. What we have shown is that there are 25,000 plus unaccounted for ballots. That's a manifestation of the risk. Over 25,000 ballots magically appeared between the day after the polls closed, November 9th, and November 10th. What was reported as the official results, just the ballot count, mind you, not the results of the election. This is just the number of ballots that were received. There are 25,000 more reported on November 10th than there were on November 9th. And I'll give you this was just a great find with the defendants in their answering briefs to our appeal. They were very helpful to us. They argued that all of the chain of custody documents had been produced and therefore nothing to see here. Well, the documents that they produced to support that, and they cited in their briefs, there were two kinds. There was a delivery receipt that is the document Runbeck uses to record the number of ballots that are delivered to them. And there are a series of them because there are multiple deliveries. And then the other set of documents that they helpfully provided to us and to the court were documents reflecting the ballots that were scanned. And those are scanned in like 10,000 ballot batches. Well, we went and looked at them and decided to add up all the receipts, and they added up to about 263,000 plus, and we could give a precise figure, and we cited that, of ballots that were received that Runbeck said, we received 263,000 plus ballots on election day. And then we went and looked at how many they said they had scanned. Well, it's 298,942, which is like, well, wait a minute. How are you scanning more ballots, 33,000 ballots or more, than you say you received? And that is just gold. Yeah. And it illustrates why chain of custody is so important, because that shouldn't happen. They should be able, and they're required by law to track every ballot that is cast. And if you have 33,000 ballots showing up unaccounted for, where did that come from? And it just so happens, of course, that Katie Hobbs won by a 17,000 vote margin. So this is devastating to the defense. They admit they did not follow mandatory chain of custody procedures on election day because there were too many ballots coming in.
That's amazing. Now, I do want to bring up, now this is obviously not related to this case, but we learned in the 2021 audit that they did in Maricopa County, we learned that the at Runbeck, who prints the ballots, not just for Maricopa County, but for a lot of other jurisdictions across the United States, Fulton County, Georgia being one of them, we learned that when in Maricopa County, when you mail your ballot back, it doesn't go to the county itself. It actually goes to Runbeck and is stored there until election day. And if I'm wrong on something here, Kurt.
No, you're absolutely correct.
Feel free. Yeah, I was going to say, feel free to correct me. But
it's actually mailed out from Runbeck too.
Right, right. And they scan it in. They have these high-speed scanners, and that's the justification for doing it. Perhaps it's time Maricopa County invests in their own high-speed scanner so we take out third-party vendors from having this type of undue influence on the election, especially given what you guys have discovered now in your case. But what I always found absolutely incredibly ironic and unforgivable is that in the 2021 audit that Cyber Ninjas and Doug Logan did, they were forbidden from talking to Runbeck. Runbeck was not allowed to answer any of the questions in that audit. And that is an important aspect of the audit, where the ballots are stored before they're transferred back and forth, and printing issues and scanning issues and chain of custody and all that stuff. Among other things, obviously the Splunk logs, we didn't get any of the Splunk logs or the router stuff. And we also, what was the other thing that we didn't get there?
Well, there's a second server that Maricopa maintains that they weren't given access to either.
Correct. And the other thing was the poll pads. They use a very unique poll pad in Maricopa County that nobody else in the country uses, and they weren't allowed to do any type of audit or analysis on that as well. So, like I said, you are showing there is a lot that needs to be evaluated here, and you need those other counts in order to continue with that, the signature verification to show that perhaps, there was an insertion of ballots somewhere along the line here, or maybe there was none. And we all have to eat crow, but let's see what happens.
Well, it does beg the question, how do you count more ballots than you recorded receiving? That's a problem. And we can win on any one of those counts, we can win. We show outcome determinative violations of law with any one of the accounts that we proceeded forward on trial. You add to it, of course, we are appealing the signature verification and Shelby Bush's findings, which it's one thing to talk about, tens of thousands of ballots with signatures that don't match, or I believe actually the number goes out to well over 150,000 for 2020 and the same for 2022. But it's quite a bit different to actually see the signatures. And I don't know if you saw Shelby's presentation, but when you see these signatures side by side, it's startling.
Yeah, it's not even close.
That visual is just incredible.
Yeah, it's not even close. Before we get into the slog files, which you mentioned earlier, I want to just focus real quick on the trial itself from a few weeks ago. Clay Parikh, you mentioned Clay Parikh, who has been on my show a couple times now, and God bless him for having the guts to do what he's doing, especially in the industry that he's in right now. He still has the guts to do what's right, and I expect nothing less from a Marine like that. We have that kind of that brotherhood there, the Marine Corps brotherhood. So,
Semper Fi.
Heck yeah, Semper Fi. I want to ask. So. We learned through Clay Parikh, Scott Jarrett had testified that there were three voting centers, vote anywhere centers, that had this shrink to fit. Well, I love the way that you set up the question on the first day when you were talking to him, and he was saying ballot definitions. And you're like, no, I'm not saying ballot definitions, ballot images. Can a smaller ballot image, fit on the paper, and what would happen? And you got them all tied up on there. But he said it happened three times, and it happened in three locations, and about 1,300 ballots were affected. Well, then you get Clay Parikh's testimony, who had the opportunity to look at six randomly chosen locations, look at ballots from there, and he found that it occurred in all six of them. So out of a random sample of six locations, you had 100% find that you guys were correct in your assessment. What does that is first off, is that enough justification to expand an investigation to figure out how much more this happened and actually get physical ballots from other locations to confirm or disprove this theory?
Well, it absolutely is. But let me back up just a moment. When I examined Scott Jarrett the first day of trial, he denied that there was any way a 19-inch ballot image could be appear projected onto a 20-inch ballot. That shrink to fit excuse occurred day two. He did not mention that day one. He unequivocally said it could never happen, didn't happen, no way. And then as soon as he said that, I actually shifted the order of our witnesses because I was stunned when he was talking like this. And I brought Clay on the stand immediately following his testimony to bookend it for the court. And if you remember, the defendant's cross was incredible. I mean, I think they were even flabbergasted because, I mean, they were asking him like, well, you know, you appeared with the My Pillow guy at the Moment of Truth Summit, didn't you, Mr. Parikh? I mean, like questions like that, which, you know, if you don't have anything to ask, that's the kind of question you ask. And that's exactly what they did. So yeah. They were stunned and they concocted this shrink to fit excuse for day two after Clay's testimony. And it absolutely is a reason to investigate further, but it's also a reason right now to set aside the election for misconduct. That would never have happened had logic and accuracy testing been performed. And that's required by Arizona law, and they didn't do it. And it was actually very funny because we brought this out in our reply brief. Scott Jarrett on the stand repeatedly referred to stress testing, which is not logic and accuracy testing. It's completely different. Logic and accuracy testing is designed to make sure the tabulators will read all the ballots, and it's required under Arizona law for all deployable voting equipment to be tested. That includes the ballot on demand printers. So this whole debacle that we all know about on election day would never have occurred had they tested according to logic and accuracy procedures. Stress testing is just running ballots through the printer, seeing if they're going to print paper, not running them through the tabulators and checking. And so they parsed it, but where Maricopa in particular in their brief, they came out and said, defendants or plaintiffs are wrong. We performed all logic and accuracy testing exactly according to law. And Hobbs parsed their test, but their briefs, so they're very careful. They just said, well, we did test it. They didn't say logic and accuracy testing. And it was quite funny because we were able to, I call it a pie in the face to Maricopa with their brief, because they are flat out misleading the court. And we said that in our reply brief, that they are misleading the court on this issue and on several other issues, by the way. So I really like our reply, if you can't tell. They gave us a number of gifts.
It is very well written. The logic and accuracy test was a huge thing. And you just said right now, this is crazy that you said this, because you said just on what we just talked about, the 6 out of 6, 100%, you know, and denying that there was any ballot images that were shrunk down to 19 inches. That to me, that was huge, but that wasn't even the biggest takeaway from this. The biggest takeaway was the very next day when Scott Jarrett was on the stand and said that this has happened in 3 other elections.
Yeah.
We were live streaming it. And when he said that, my jaw dropped.
Yeah.
This happened 3 times before. And you are just now doing a root cause analysis to figure out what's going on here and why this is occurring. To me, look, you guys had an incredible standard. You had to prove misconduct. You had to prove, you know, the quantity of the ballots and all that stuff. You did it you didn't do it. Scott Jarrett did it right there. The fact that he's known that this has happened in 3 other elections and has done nothing to fix it, that in and of itself is criminal. That's in my, and look, I don't know the law in Arizona. That's criminal negligence. If you knowingly allow something to happen over and over and over 3 times, over and over and over, and you disenfranchise voters, you take away their 14th Amendment rights, and you're single-handedly basically attacking one specific type of voter, in-person voters, which we know lean heavily conservative. If that's not misconduct, I don't know what is.
Yeah, well, I have some doubts about this whole shrink to fit excuse. Like I said, they concocted it the day after. And so it's admissions like that and other statements, like it only occurred in 3 voting centers when Clay testified and he saw them in all 6 that he selected, where they said they began the root cause analysis the day they discovered this after the election, that they're still performing their root cause analysis. Yet they never mentioned this in their response to the Attorney General. If you recall, on November 19th, 2 weeks after the, or 11 days after the election, the Attorney General issued a letter wanting documentation to explain a number of events that happened on election day, such as the chaos on this. They, on November 26th, they put forward about a 12-page response with about 8 different exhibits, hundreds of pages of exhibits. Not once in that letter did they mention this issue. And it was something that the AG specifically focused on. And not once did they mention it. Yet, the day after trial, when Clay Parikh reveals his stunning findings, this shrink to fit excuse magically appears. And then they admit, like you said, that it had nothing to see here because it's occurred in 3 prior elections, no big deal. And you're thinking, what did I just hear? Because like you said, it shows prior knowledge. So
let's, okay, I want to move on. I want to get into the slog files here for just a second, because this is absolutely, I think this is breaking. I don't think this has been published yet. So we're going to go over this real quick. But before we get to that aspect of it, I got to talk about Ryan Macias for a second. I've been kind of following him for the last couple years, going back to the 2020 election. And we saw him on the stand here in Maricopa County in your trial. You brought it to the judge's attention that he looks like he was reading. Clearly he was reading. I mean, there is, I do this for a living. I can see what people are doing on the screen and I can tell where they're looking. I can tell when somebody's reading comments. One of my guests is reading comments instead of talking with me. I can tell. And when you're looking at Macias and you're looking at him, look to the side like this. And then, you know, now there's a rumor. And maybe you can put this to bed or maybe you can't confirm it at all. There's a rumor that he was in the courthouse that day, but he did not come into the courtroom. Is there any validity to that?
I heard that. I don't have any proof of that.
Okay. So we don't have any proof of that. Now, just real quick, what's the significance of him testifying via Zoom? This is something that has just absolutely blown my mind. And Stephen Richard did the same thing, which to me was unacceptable as well. You knew that this was coming up. You got, I'm sure he got served and everything along those lines, and he couldn't be there in person, but it is what it is. But Ryan Macias is clearly reading. What's the significance of that as an attorney that's watching somebody off screen that is deliberate enough to, read something? Is what are the odds that somebody's there coaching him, putting something on the screen as it's going? I mean, that's a big deal.
Well, Brian Blem, my colleague, you know, is actually the one that did the cross-examination and called it out to the court that he was clearly reading. And he wasn't just looking down for a brief moment. He was actually just looking down and to the right and giving his answer as if he was reading from a script. I mean, that's what it appeared to be. But the significance of it is, you know, it makes it more difficult to do a cross-examination, but it does allow Macias, who appeared to be reading, to read a scripted answer is what it looked to be. I will say this on some of, you know, one of the other difficulties of this trial, you know, we only had 5.5 hours to present our entire case over 2 days. And so the clock was ticking, but it would have been nice if we had had more time to drill down on Macias on that issue as well as his qualifications because or lack thereof. Maricopa has trotted him out as an expert and his qualifications don't stand scrutiny in terms of his cyber skills. And you match him up against somebody like Clay Parikh and there's no comparison.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was one of the other discouraging things about this is that you guys so I after your trial we live streamed the Abe Hamada trial, and in that trial at the end in the closing arguments the judge said, look, this is a case where normally, you know, you bring forward in December of 2022 you submit your lawsuit and all that, and it doesn't get heard until probably December of 2023 or maybe even December of 2024. You have all this time to discovery, witnesses, depositions, and all that stuff. You guys had like a week. That is crazy. And this is something, it's not, election law is not something that everybody practices. It's not a very popular, well, I don't know how popular it is in the law field, but it's not a very common thing. And you have to learn all new laws. You have to, you know, Arizona's laws are different than Florida's, which are different than Colorado's, which are different than Pennsylvania's. And so it's a very complicated thing, which you guys had to do. And the fact that you guys were able to pull it off and do what you guys did was absolutely incredible. So kudos to that. I want to jump into the slog files now, because this is something that I don't think anybody's seen yet. So let's go ahead and pull this up here. Yep. And I'm going to make it full screen like so right there. Now, do you want me to read this, or do you want to explain what this is before we?
I can explain what it is. And so the backdrop for this is that the defendants have repeatedly told the court that there were a few hiccups during the election, but that these problems were resolved early in the day, so nothing to see here. And the evidence that we had at trial were witness statements. We had over 200 declarations. And they were admitted into court, they're under oath, they're powerful. They showed that over 132 of 223 vote centers had problems. But necessarily in testimony, you can't get as granular as to an overall perspective. I mean, it's just one individual witness's perspective of what happened at that time they were in the vote center. The slog files, the system log files, tell the whole story system-wide. So the system log files, which apply for every single tabulator at each of the 223 vote centers and the tabulators at Central Count, we have those files now. And what this chart shows, this is broken up in half-hour increments. And to my left is the beginning at 6 a.m. You can see, and these are the number of ballot rejections across the board, the total ballot rejections by half hour. And it shoots up well past 7,000 immediately. Like as soon as the polls open, boom, chaos ensues. And it doesn't even drop off below 7,000 until 8 p.m. And so you see across the top there, the issues are never resolved. And so this, once again, shows everybody, the court, everybody, that Maricopa has been misleading the public, has been misleading the court when they say these problems were resolved early in the day. The slog file data proves otherwise. And this is an extraordinary development. There were over a total of 217,000 ballot rejections. Now, a ballot rejection, if you put your ballot in four times in the tabulator, that's four rejections. So a system log file records activity on the tabulators or any of its devices. So every event that occurs is recorded. And of the 217,000, I believe it's about 100 and a little over 180,000 are what we call non-voluntary rejections. There are some rejections that where somebody didn't fill out the ballot correctly, so they pulled it out. But the vast, vast majority are rejections that occurred not due to the voter canceling their vote. So this shows that these problems were they were huge. They lasted the entire day, and that Maricopa is not telling the true story.
And so let me just make sure that people understand that what you're saying right here, I mean, you're talking about 7,000 ballot rejections, a 7,000 ballot rejection rate per half hour.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, just think of don't even worry about those ballots themselves. Think of how many people don't get to vote, or how many people show up and see a line that's stretched out like to the next block and around the building, and then, you know, up over the hill on the other side, and people got to walk all the way back there. These are people that are taking off an hour for lunch to go vote on their lunch break. These are people that, you know, have to go pick up their kids at 3 p.m. And how many people drive by there and look at that and they're like, I'm not waiting on that line. I can't wait on that line. This is something that should not be the way it is. The EAC, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Kurt, but I believe the EAC allows a rejection rate of 1 in 500 ballots, including voter error.
Correct.
I think I'm right on that. So you're looking at a rejection rate here of 7,000 ballots. We don't know the comparison number, but
it's over 235 times the EACs allow.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, it's not even close.
235 times the rejection rate allowable by the EAC. Yeah. Kurt, at what point are we going to say enough is enough? This they give us this human error, technical glitch. It's a small little error. We got it fixed. Don't worry. Everything's fine now. You're looking here at a candidate in Kari Lake, God bless her. You're looking at a candidate in Kari Lake that was up 11 points, that her opponent wouldn't debate her. She absolutely destroyed her opponent in every facet of this election. And then you have this, all this crap happened to her. I get fired up when I see
it. It's frustrating, but look at what's happening, because all of this information is now being revealed. And it used to be the narrative was, I was involved back in the 2020. So I was one of the primary drafters of the complaint that Texas filed in the Supreme Court. I'll never forget that day. It was such a rush when 18 other states came in and joined Texas. It's a beautiful thing to see. And if you remember, the narrative was the most secure election in history. Fast forward 2 years, you don't hear that anymore. They're not even disputing it, because we're getting the evidence. We haven't given up. We're never going to give up. And we're going to continue to expose the fraud and the cheating and the use of the machines and mail-in voting and everything else that's being done to rig our elections. And so we're winning the narrative war. And I hope next comes the courts. And that's where we are.
So on that note, Mr. Olson, I want to be respectful of your time. Give us an overview of where we go from here, what the next steps are in this case, and where we're going from here.
Well, we're waiting for the Court of Appeals is going to conference on February 1st. That's where the judges get together themselves and decide how they're going to, if they're going to talk about the case. Now, at that point, they may decide they have some questions. And they have the discretion to obviously order oral argument for the parties to appear to answer any unresolved issues, or they can just issue an opinion. And I think no matter which way they rule, whether it is for us or for the defendants, the case is going to go to the Arizona Supreme Court. And the Arizona Supreme Court yesterday, we had moved when we filed our reply brief. It was the last day you could do this. Under the procedural rules, to file a petition to transfer the case immediately to the Arizona Supreme Court. And they denied that, but they noted that the Court of Appeals was moving expeditiously and they were looking forward to them to issue an order quickly. So they understand the exigency of these circumstances. And so I expect that we will be up before the Arizona Supreme Court in short order. It could be, I would think, a matter of weeks, if not maybe a month or something like that. But that's my hope and expectation.
Well, we are definitely looking forward to it. We'll be covering it over here on Badlands Daily as well as on the Gateway Pundit. Mr. Olson, any final words or thoughts? Any where can people follow you? Where can people get up to date on the case as we progress through this?
I am on Truth Social under my name, Kurt Olson. And in terms of words, of encouragement, you never give up. And the fact that people like you and everybody else are not giving up, that's what's driving the other side crazy. And this is a battle of wills. And like I said before, the narrative has completely shifted from the way it was 2 years ago. And that should tell you something. They no longer even can hide it anymore. And at some point, the dam will burst.
Amen, sir. Between the Project Veritas drop we got yesterday.
Oh my God, that was amazing.
That was incredible.
Did you see where Newsweek fact-checked Pfizer's own, executive vice president in charge? I mean, they fact-checked him and said, I think it was undetermined or unverified. Like, they couldn't verify what Pfizer's own executive was saying, what they were doing in terms of doing gene manipulation.
It's unreal what we're seeing. I've been monitoring Google. If you type in Pfizer, what is it? Pfizer Project Veritas. If you Google Pfizer Project Veritas, for the last 12 hours, it's been an error message. And I've documented this. I documented it last night on a Twitter space, and I documented it again today on my Badlands Daily podcast, just to show people that Google is freaking out. They're trying to get ahead of this narrative and figure out how they're going to control it. And they can't control it anymore. They can't control the COVID narrative. They can't control the vaccine narrative. They're not going to be able to control the election narrative with everything that's come out about the FBI collusion, the DHS collusion, the EISAC, and the Twitter portal, which Hobbs took advantage of in that election, everything that's coming out in this regard. And now, most importantly, where you guys are, that you're getting actual evidence on the record, on the court record, in a court of law. It's absolutely incredible. I 100% believe that the narrative's completely starting to flip in our direction, and we got to do it quick, because in 2024, that is going to be the election where it either goes, they just go all in and they completely screw over the American populace, or we actually get our way and we figure out the truth of what's going on.
Exactly.
So, Mr. Olson, thank you so much for joining us. And hopefully, you know, as this case progresses and maybe after the fact, we can get you back on again.
Would love to, and really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much, sir. And give our best to Miss Lake next time you speak to her. We appreciate her passion and her drive and fighting here.
She's terrific.
Absolutely. All right. Take care, sir. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for this episode here. Thank you guys all so much for tuning in. If you want to support this podcast, you can jump on over to, speaking of Mike Lindell, mypillow.com. You can use promo code CANCON to save up to 66%. I know Kurt had mentioned Clay Parikh being drilled about the MyPillow thing, Mike Lindell and all that, which I was screaming too. I'm like, expert witnesses are always paid. I mean, that's not anything new. Expert witnesses get paid. But in the Lake v. Hobbs case that I believe Mr. Olson also argued earlier, a federal case, it was really funny. Clay Parikh's deposition, they asked him about Mike Lindell, and he said, I heard he makes really great pillows. I don't have one personally. Hopefully he does by now. So on that note, folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay frosty. God bless each and every one of you. God bless America. Make the fortune cookie country pay for this.